As always, the opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS, the U.S. Department of Defense, or the U.S. government.
And concurrently, we'll work this other one. We know it's going to be slower. We know it's going to cost more money. But by going in this direction, at least we have a larger shot of getting to having submarines in the end. What do you think, Lonnie?
Yeah, I mean, I think that if they are really, really interested in building nuclear power submarines and then they're building them in the United States, is, you know, condition, and I think that they will probably do it. And then it may cost
despite
more.
Despite the cost?
And Hanwha Ocean recently said that they can build nuclear power submarines in Philly Shipyard.
Aloha, and welcome to Strategic Voices. I'm James Minnick, Colonel United States Army retired and professor, joined by my colleagues, Professor Sean Taquani and Lami Kim, here at the Daniel K. Inouye, Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies in Honolulu, Hawaii. South Korea is eyeing nuclear-powered submarines, but beyond the headlines, a central question looms. What would this capability actually change for Seoul's deterrence, its alliance with Washington, and the regional maritime balance? To be clear, this is not a discussion about nuclear weapons. It's about propulsion, endurance, stealth, and sustained presence in an intensifying undersea theater. Today, we move past the prestige narrative to examine the cold strategic logic. We'll weigh three distinct perspectives: the AUKUS precedent, roadmap, or cautionary tale; the deterrence case, can nuclear submarines serve as a decisive non-nuclear deterrent; and the cost reality. Do the strategic gains justify the industrial, political, and non-proliferation risks? The issue isn't just whether South Korea can build them. It's what happens to deterrence, alliance dynamics, and the stability of Northeast Asia if it does. So, team, what's going on?
Good to be back together again. How you been?
James. Yeah, I've been doing pretty well. I had a pretty quiet holiday season. I had a lot of writing to do. I owed a lot of manuscripts, one of them to you, James. But thanks for your patience. I did deliver that.
You did.
And then I made my New Year's resolutions. And
have you broken them already?
Yes, just 2 weeks into the new year, I've broken them already. But that's what Lunar New Year is for.
You gotta redo.
So I can start anew. So there's the hope.
Won't ask you to tell us what it was, but if you think later you want to divulge, then share with us.
Yeah, just, you know, like working out like three times a week, like meditating every morning. Not happening.
I actually meditated for years. Oh my goodness, years and years and years. My father was really good at that. How about it, Sean? What you been up to?
Well, I'm happy to say that with age comes wisdom. And one part of wisdom is don't make resolutions. It saves you angst and sleepless nights, etc. But beyond that, and with age, it'll come. So not so, but it'll come. And I've been doing some writing myself and working on reworking the chapters.
Yes, yes, you got two of them coming for this book. Thank you for
exactly.
That.
But I think the real thing for me was this topic when we decided this topic. It triggered a memory for me. It's a very old memory. I'm going back to when I was growing up as a teenager. My father had a small collection of Second World War books, which I happily inherited. I have them. And as a teenager, I would pull them off the shelf, you know, more out of curiosity than understanding. What does a 15, 16-year-old guy know about these things? Yeah. One title stayed with me, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with it. It's called Run Silent, Run Deep.
Oh, of course, yes.
Written by, it's a novel, by Commander, later who became Captain Edward L. Beach, Jr., 1955. And simply, I thought going back to that book might prepare me better for our conversation today. So I later saw the movie, Run Silent, Run Deep.
Yep.
Clark Gable, Burt Lancaster. It was usual. It was a usual thing of the era. It was dramatic, memorable in its own way. But what really endured for me wasn't the movie. It was the mood and the atmosphere and the book.
Say more.
It still haunts me. I mean, that whole thing.
Yeah.
So the book is quieter. It's not like the movie. It's more about waiting, restraint, and the discipline of operating unseen. The submarine's power, I went back to read the book.
Yeah,
that's one of the things I did. the submarine's power comes not from constant action, like the movies.
Yeah.
Crimson Tide, and there was that
some. There's another one that just
Sean Connery's movie. I don't remember the names.
I can't remember.
It comes from presence, not constant action, and from the uncertainty it creates for the other side.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, the, you know, the whole thing was around the Pearl Harbor episode from the Pacific, the whole story about that. And the atmosphere stayed with me even today.
Yeah.
So when I went back, of course,
pulled all these memories back to you.
Part of it was still the same. Part of it changed when you reread it. I was reading it after God, you know, when as a teenager. Now I'm not. First time I was reading it after then, and so the atmosphere stayed with me long after the details faded. It for me it was a very analog way of absorbing ideas about deterrence.
Nice.
Through books on the shelf.
Yeah.
Long before we had slides. Podcasts or strategy papers to explain that. So while reading about South Korea's nuclear-powered submarine debate, that the readings that you sent, the mood came back, just come back. So because beneath what we're going to be talking about, I suppose, all the technical and alliance questions, submarines are still about that same logic, which is endurance, silence, and signaling without display. So when we ask whether SSNS are about capability or signal, I would say they've always been about both, provided they're handled with restraint.
Yeah.
And I think I'll swing the question back to you. What have you been up to?
What have I been up to? Well,
well, that was a long...
No. That was quite interesting. Thanks for sharing that. And the memories that come from thinking about the book and the movie. I too took a little bit of time off. Family spent a little bit of time on New Year's, played a few board games and stuff like that, had a good time. And then I promptly got right down to business, even though I was off, and because we're getting real close to sending the book, the second volume in the series off to the printer. We'll talk about it more, but both of you contributing to it. It's, you know, it's 20 chapters in the book, so there's a lot pulling on this. And this is, you know, America's strategic edge, and it is in recognition of the nation's 250th anniversary. We'll celebrate that as well this year. And so really excited about that. In fact, the next episode, we're going to talk a little bit about the conditions, the environment on that, and we'll just leave that much as a teaser. But it's been fast and furious, and there's a lot of things coming up, and I'll even mention some of that maybe later. But this is an exciting topic. Lami chose the topic. I'm really glad she did. I mean, it's extremely contemporary with things that are going on. But I mean, for reality, if you've been in Korea, this is a long enduring desire. And so maybe we'll even get into some of this. So this is not born out of a off-the-cuff ask. There's a lot of history here, and maybe we'll bring up some of that as well. But Lami, you've brought this to us. You sent us some readings, and maybe we'll let you kick us off. Tell us what we
got. Sure. So in order to set the stage, I will provide some background information. So in October last year, when President Trump was visiting Gyeongju, South Korea, President Lee Jae-myung and Trump had a summit, and the focus was, we anticipated that the focus of the summit will be about the trade, you know, deal, trade agreement, tariffs, and all that. But then, sort of somewhat unexpectedly, President Lee brought up the issue of nuclear-powered submarines and asked for Washington's support for South Korea's development of nuclear-powered submarines. The reason why South Korea needed Washington's support is because under the bilateral nuclear cooperation agreement, which is called 1-2-3 agreement, South Korea is prohibited from using nuclear technology for military purposes. Obviously, nuclear power submarines are for military purposes. So that was a surprise. Mm-hmm. But President Trump, somewhat surprisingly also, wrote in Truth Social that the U.S. would grant the approval to South Korea, and then South Korean submarines will be built in Hanwha shipyard in Philadelphia, Philly shipyard. And about 2 weeks later, the two countries released a joint fact sheet that also confirmed the Washington support, the U.S.'s support for the submarines development. So as you alluded to already in the intro, there are three, broadly speaking, three issues: feasibility, and then the military utility or desirability issue, and some risks involved. And the three readings that I suggested, I will briefly summarize them one by one. The first one was written by Professor Chumbong-gun, a very prominent nuclear scholar at the Korean National Defense Diplomatic Academy. He lays out reasons why South Korea needs nuclear power submarines. One is to counter North Korea's nuclear threats. North Korea continues to enhance its nuclear weapons and missile capabilities, and it has recently adopted a nuclear doctrine that allows for preemptive use of nuclear weapons. And also, North Korea is developing nuclear power submarines itself as well, and it has the capability to launch ballistic missiles from submarines. To counter that, you know, South Korean nuclear weapons, nuclear power submarines will be necessary, he argues. And also, South Korea's nuclear power submarines will enhance the collective deterrent capabilities of the U.S. and its allies and partners in the region, and thereby contributing to maintaining peace and stability in the region. And also, the submarines can contribute to global security by providing the public good of ensuring and enhancing maritime security. So South Korea's nuclear power submarines is a good thing for the world and the region, not only for South Korea. And the other piece is written by Mr. George Moore, who is a researcher at Middlebury Institute, who also served at the International Atomic Energy Agency. He argues that actually nuclear power submarines are not necessarily better than diesel electric submarines. I mean, he sort of kind of warns against building these submarines because they are not necessarily better. You know, I mean, this diesel electric submarines can stay underwater for up to 30 days. I mean, with this new technology called air independent propulsion, so they can stay underwater for an extended period of time. The only thing he argues, the only advantage of nuclear power submarines is speed, and the speed will help South Korea, you know, deter China. Not only North Korea, but also China. However, he thinks that the benefits are outweighed by the costs or risks, especially sort of the damage to the global non-proliferation regime. And also, he believes that South Korea's buildup of nuclear power submarines could trigger an arms race with China, with North Korea, and other countries like Japan and Pakistan could also follow suit. So he thinks that it's better to actually lease nuclear power submarines from the United States than building South Korea building them themselves itself, especially because there are some barriers. Because he thinks that building the submarines in Philly shipyard is quote unquote non-starter, because this submarine, I mean, this shipyard is not nuclear certified, and so just getting the necessary approval would take forever, take years. And also, the 1-3 agreement that I mentioned will have to be revised because as it is now, it bans South Korea from using nuclear technology for military purposes. He thinks that that will be hard, especially after the midterm election and future elections, the makeup of Congress could change, and then things will become difficult. The last piece written by Ji-hoon Yu, who is a research fellow at the Korean Institute of Defense Analysis, which is a research wing of the Ministry of Defense, Ministry of National Defense. He argues that, you know, many South Koreans believe that, oh, Australians are building nuclear power submarines. We can build them too. But he argues that the AUKUS case, Australian model, should be considered as a warning for South Korea, not a blueprint to copy, because there are several issues there with Australia. First of all, it will take forever. It will take not forever. It will take a very long time. And then there is no clear division of labor among Australia, the UK, and the United States. And so who's going to build what and where could be a thorny, could become a thorny issue. And then also Australia has to deal with this proliferation concerns because Australian submarines will be very likely be fueled by highly enriched uranium, even if South Korea uses low enriched uranium, given the fact that South Koreans have been sort of calling for nuclear armament for some time. It will raise sort of alarm and sort of suspicion that South Korea will try to take advantage of technology to build nuclear weapons. So there's a lot to unpack here.
No, that was amazing. I could be a student in one of your classes. That was like a lecture. That was wonderful. There really is a lot to pull on there. And I was thinking of these pieces, these articles, when I thought about, like I said, what are the justifications that they need? Because in actuality, not everything that is being put forward is actually... takes us closer towards a rationale, a real reason to be able to have nuclear weapons. In fact, Jun didn't convince me on many of the things he said, and maybe we'll pull some on those. But I know, but I acknowledge that. I mean, it was published on KoreaNet. KoreaNet is a government platform which maybe in some regards signifies a little bit how Korea is thinking about these justifications, but we don't want to conflate what they can really do and maybe what the capabilities are not inherent. And so maybe we'll pull on some of that a bit, and then maybe we might take ourselves through and we can, you know, if we go to George Moore's piece, then we talk about a little bit about the uncertainties and then on to Yu's piece, and we can talk about some of these warnings. And I think there are a lot of things we can pull out of that. I think if I were going to give just a little bit more context even before we pull on this, so how many countries out there actually have nuclear powered submarines? And I guess the answer is six. And so five of them are the P5, the permanent five nations. And so the United States, the UK, France, Russia, and China. The only exception to that is India, but India then obtained theirs from Russia, and they did that. Well, I should be more clear. They actually obtained the first one from the Soviet Union, so in the 80s, and then later the second one from Russia, and you might pull some more on that. And so now what we're talking after that are those which are exceptions to the rule. Before AUKUS, Brazil, probably since the 70s, has had aspirations of having nuclear-powered submarines, and they have come a long way in that. We'll maybe pull on that on the next thought I'm thinking. And then, of course, AUKUS is the exception to it, as it were. And now South Korea, they're like, well, if there's one exception, there can be another exception. And North Korea is, of course, 5 years ago, they put forward in the 8th Party Congress that they were going to put forward, work towards the development of the nuclear-powered submarines. 2 years ago, of course, didn't show a nuclear-powered submarine. They did release a modified Romeo-class submarine, which was significantly evolved and had, I think it had like 10 vertical launch tubes in it. And so they were really starting to think and move in such a direction. I think the second point I would note as we, for a broad thinking on this, is when we talk about nuclear power, there are three current ways that is being done. There is highly enriched uranium at a weapons grade level. So that's 90% or more of processing of the uranium. And so there's only two countries that operate those right now, presently, and that's the United States and the UK. And you would note that those, under that model, these are lifetime, don't need to be refueled. They're going to last 40 plus years of operation. Mm-hmm. Then there's highly enriched uranium, which is then at the 40 or 60% level. Russia operates that, and then because they transferred to India, the logical leap is that that's the same type that India does. And this probably, it doesn't have near the endurance level. I mean, probably, I don't know, 25 or so years. But you know, now you're approaching perhaps a typical life shelf life of a frame of the hall of a hall, anyhow, 25, 30 years or so. And then the light and rich uranium, so the LEUs, France and China both are in that one, and Korea is also looking in there. And of course, this is, you know, LEUs are much less proliferation risk. It maybe it doesn't rise, you know, the hackles is in concern, particularly in countries like South Korea. From the 70s, they had a covert nuclear weapons program under Park Chung-hee administration. They have more recently and vociferously been saying, perhaps we need nuclear weapons again. And so for other countries, they're like, you know, if that were to be the case, an LEU is clearly. But the United States, you know, BWX Technologies does not have a model for LEU reactors, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's a point to consider. And so there is, you know, that in itself kind of makes us ask a lot of questions, as we may do, particularly as we're thinking about industrial capability or other things. I'll stop there for a minute. Sham, you looked like you were thinking.
Yeah, I was basically, I'm pulling back a bit, and I want to inject a little bit of India, but and this is an area where I'm just beginning to acquire more familiarity with the topic. So I started when you send the readings, and I'll give you a gist of what I took out of the readings, but I could have got it wrong, but let's see. So number one is Asia is entering an era of undersea normalization. I think that was, it didn't come in the readings, but that's what I've been looking at. And submarines, especially nuclear powered ones, are becoming instruments of persistence, signaling, and alliance bargaining, not just war fighting. So I think this debate, that this conversation, it sits squarely inside that shift. That's my take. So taken together, all these readings that you sent, very interesting, I learned a lot. They show to me that South Korea's nuclear submarine debate isn't really about submarines. It's about time horizons, alliance trust, and non-proliferation politics, and a more distributed undersea burden inside the alliance. That's the way I read it. So the readings show me three things. These programs take decades, not political cycles. They demand extraordinary discipline and safeguards, and then they inevitably send strategic signals, now whether you like it or not, intended or not. For South Korea, I think the question isn't just whether nuclear-powered submarines are feasible, but how they affect alliance credibility, regional stability, and non-proliferation politics all at once. Now, I want to talk a little bit about India's experience. India's experience shows that undersea capability isn't just about deterrence. It changes how others listen to you. And I think this is about strategic signaling, intended or not. India's experience also shows that nuclear submarines are not symbols of arrival. They are instruments of restraint. Now, two points I have, which is, I mentioned this earlier, but India's experience shows that even when intent is defensive, nuclear submarines still raise questions for neighbors. The platform sends signals whether you want to or not. And then I had a question for the panel. Now, if you look at the combined, it reminds us, if you look at India's experience again, it reminds us that nuclear submarines, they solve the survivability problem. In India's case, it was second deterrence. Mm-hmm. They solve that problem very well, but they also quietly reshape timelines, alliances, and expectations in ways that last far longer than the platform itself. So given all of this, how's South Korea thinking about managing the long-term signaling and alliance effects of nuclear-powered submarines? Not just the operational gains, especially with China and Russia watching closely, and also whether South Korea's SSNs reinforce restraint or accelerate competition. And I think that will depend less on the hull than on the politics wrapped around it. So I'm just throwing back to you.
Yeah, well, thank you for the insightful comments. I think that, you know, the way that South Koreans are thinking about this nuclear power submarines is that, you know, they really need them because North Korea is building them. And then North Korea will probably get there first because they're already building the ship, right? I mean, last month, North Korea's media, Korean Central News Agency, released images of North Korea's nuclear power submarines. I mean, I'm sure, you know, probably they don't have the reactor yet in the ship, but the ship is really big. It's almost like it looked pretty complete.
And this was not the the modified Romeos that we're talking about. These are new ships.
Yeah, these are just 8,900 tons.
They were quite impressive.
Right. And so, but I was thinking when, you know, back in 2021, North Korea, you know, said that they were going to build nuclear power submarines. I wrote a piece actually saying that, well, it's not going to happen because at the time, and then also I said there, so therefore there is not going to be a race for nuclear power submarines on the Korean Peninsula because South Korea cannot build them because they don't have the approval from Washington. North Korea cannot build them because they don't have the technology and capability to build them. But the situation has changed dramatically. South Korea got the approval. North Korea can get the support from Russia. So media reports have said that North Korea is already getting support from Russia. It has not been verified. However, it is not too far-fetched to think that, you know, North Korea is getting some sensitive military technologies, including nuclear power submarine technology, in return for its help for Russia's war efforts against Ukraine. And so now I believe that it is actually possible, the arms race on the Korean Peninsula is really possible. But there's no consensus on whether South Korea really needs nuclear power submarines to deter even North Korea because, you know, nuclear power submarines, you know, can be valuable in deep, far away places, but North Korea just right up there for South Korea. And then the waters in the vicinity of the Korean Peninsula are shallow. And so submarines are not very effective there. Actually, in that, you know, shallow water, small, nimble diesel electric submarines with some maybe unmanned, you know, underwater vehicles will be so much more efficient. However, this is based on the assumption that North Korea won't be able to go far out there because, you know, they don't have the technology to make their submarines quiet. And so at this point, their submarines will be, you know, vulnerable. I mean, you know, not at this point, but we assume that North Korea's submarines will be vulnerable to the U.S.'s anti-submarine warfare capabilities, which are pretty advanced. But if North Korea also acquires the technology from Russia and then can roam around freely in the Pacific Ocean, I mean, I think that that's going to take a while, but some people believe that. And then in that case, I could, you know, understand the argument that they need those submarines to counter North Korea.
So, there's a lot. Let me unpack that just a bit. So, North Korea has been at this effort right now for more than a decade. In 2015, I remember when they were test launching the launch tubes for the submarine launch ballistic missiles. And kind of the consensus was, oh, this is going to take them a long time. Well, it didn't take them long at all. They successfully were able to execute that. And then, of course, I'd mentioned they've now integrated it into some of the modified Romeos. Of course, before that, they had Golday, which was, you know, the Whale, which was another submarine that had its own capabilities in that regard. So there are many components to having a successful submarine that can be able to carry out. And they, of course, operate. They have been operating with submarines for a very long time. They've got one of the larger submarine fleets on the planet, frankly, with some of their older models. And so then you say, what is it that South Korea is? What will they deter with the SSNs? And so, presently, the North Korea's real threat comes from ground mobile launchers, which, frankly, they're ubiquitous. They've got even the older systems are being that we're with liquid fuel are being replaced with the solid fuel ones. And these are, whether they're SLB, short-range ballistic missiles, which can range all of Korea, or medium-range ballistic missiles, which can range Japan, or intermediate-range ballistic missiles to Guam, or ICBMs to anywhere, frankly, on the planet, they have a very significant capability from the land. And guess what? SSNs won't deter those capabilities at all. And so, which is not to say attack submarines don't have a use, it's just not there. It has not been long ago when South Korea was asked, I can remember a show former President Yoon Suk-yeol was on and asked, hey, if war break out in the area, will you be helping out in that? And he's like, we'll have our hands busy with North Korea. You remember that Sunday talk show. Not much has changed. That still is the focused area from administrations have changed, but that's still the focus area of South Korea. And as you rightly noted, the North is right there. And so the thought that we will be out providing global security missions doesn't reconcile with comments from presidents before, we got our hands full with the North. And so if their hands are full with the North, they're not floating around and the seven seas trying to provide security.
Yes. And then that is related to what Chang was saying earlier about alliance. And so I think if the president of South Korea, I mean, not only this president and future presidents, are willing to, you know, provide really public goods in the region and, you know, more globally, I think that this, you know, nuclear power submarines in South Korea can be useful, right? I mean, they could, you know, share the U.S.'s burden and free up the U.S.'s nuclear power submarines in the region to do other things. And also, if South Korea is willing to contribute to sort of maintaining security in the Strait of Hormuz for a stable supply of oil or protecting undersea cables, you know, globally, I think that the submarines can be helpful. But, you know, when President Yoon Suk-yeol was talking about the vision of South Korea being a global pivotal state, that didn't really, you know, materialize. And I'm not really sure if President Lee will be willing to serve those roles. But I think that there are still, though, some values that this assets can bring to the alliance and to global security.
If I may interject, I was talking to some of the nuclear guys in India over the week, and they gave me 2 points, which I think is a little bit provocative. So he says, India's nuclear submarine program was built for one main reason, to make sure India can still respond if it is ever hit by a nuclear attack. Mm-hmm. It was not designed to impress allies or project power far from home. Mm. So that's one. And the other one is the debate about the submarines in South Korea is more about as a conventional stabilizing tool. Mm. That was one of the takeaways I got from conversations. Mm. Do you want to respond to that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I guess you can say that, I mean, nuclear power submarines and SLBMs, the launch, the ability to launch ballistic missiles from underseas can provide or can enhance the second strike capability. And so it could probably, you know, lower the chance of conventional conflicts, because if you believe that if I do something, I won't be able to neutralize the other's assets, and then they can hit us back with, underwater assets, then you will think twice about,
indeed.
Well, particularly in the case of India, if these are nuclear powered missiles that are being fired, but South Korea doesn't have nuclear missiles that it's firing, it's going to fire conventional missiles, which are not probably going to deter a very robust nuclear powered North Korea.
Yeah, but I think that, some people still argue that it would, I don't know if you can say really second strike capability, but still that gives you some sort of a capability to retaliate, and not with nuclear weapons because they don't have them. But, they have like a Hamun missile, which is called like a monster missile because it can carry like 8 ton of I think it was 8 ton, like a 5 ton warhead, which is, smaller than nuclear weapons, but still quite substantial. Yeah, so, but I mean, it's not a, perfect solution, but it's better. I mean, some argue it's better to have it. But another thing to consider is, but at what cost, right? I mean, obviously, if you have unlimited resources, it's better to have whatever assets you can get. But they are pretty expensive. And, these nuclear power submarines are 2 to 3 times more expensive than diesel electric submarines. And if they have to build them in the United States, they say it will be like 3 to 4 times more expensive. So if you can do the math, then it could actually be, like up to 12 times more expensive than building a diesel electric submarine. And so then you really have to think about, is this worth it?
And so let's pull on that a little bit, some of these costs. And so presently, South Korea has very capable shipyards. Hanwha Ocean is developing KSS-3, their current. So they got KSS-1s, which are their Type 209s, which they got in the 90s from Germany, and they were they built them under design from Germany. And then the 214s that they built a few years, but maybe 15 years after that. And then presently they're doing batches of the much larger ones. And I think the second batch of KSS-3s, I mean, these are 4,000 ton displacements. These are much larger ones. And so they have really robust shipbuilding capabilities for submarines. And so they probably, if you say go tomorrow, they could probably build the submarine in, I don't know, 6 years or so. That's what they're taking to build KSS-3s right now. And so, but then if we pull on something you said and then connect it to the present, and that is, this isn't the first time South Korea asked to be able to build or possess, but build SSNs. And so certainly in the Obama administration, they asked and they said no. And that was, the early teens. Mm-hmm. And they said no. But even in the Biden administration before that, hey, guess what? You just announced AUKUS. Can we get some of that deal? And they're like, no. And so for some time, U.S. administrations have said, no, don't ask. And so why is that? And I'm thinking, is it because there's the proliferation concerns that we've been speaking about? Is it this doesn't really advance the deterrence capability? We've got this covered. Is it because we're concerned about the arms race? If we go there, then others will go, and you brought this up. And so late October on the sidelines of APEC in Gyeongju, President Lee asked the question, and President Trump says, sounds like a good idea. Mm-hmm. But he had a condition on it. And you mentioned it. And that condition was, and build them in the Hanwha Philly plant. And so a couple years ago, Hanwha bought the Philly plant for not a lot, $100 million, something like that, I think is what it was. And they have even last year said, hey, we're going to upgrade it. We're going to put $5 billion more into this. Now, that is a long endeavor. To get to nuclear, to get to a plant, a yard that can build nuclear powered submarines. I mean, you're going to have to, all of the regulations and laws and rules to be able to get that, and there'll be national, state, local level rules. You and I were talking about TSMC in Arizona. And there's some 3,000 whatever regulations and laws and stuff they had to have changed so that they could put that capability, and we're talking about semiconductors, we're not talking about nuclear stuff. So that's going to take some time. And then it would take significant effort in being able to certifications and all of the things that will have to come with it. The workforce that has to be trained to be able to do these things. These are, as you were in, long-term requirements. And yet, as I'm thinking about that, if that is still the requirement, because previous presidents have said, don't think so. But now we're thinking about, well, maybe if you do it under these conditions, and those conditions are, we've got more American workers to work, and we've got more capability in there, then we could do a thing. It is going to cost more, as you said, and it is going to take a lot longer. But what if South Korea were to say, okay, we understand the requirements, so let's run two batches. We'll run some out of South Korea, Hanwha Ocean, or someplace else. And I've been down to Kujido, where the used to be the Daewoo plant down there, and seen it as really quite something. And concurrently, we'll work this other one. We know it's going to be slower. We know it's going to cost more money. But by going in this direction, at least we have a larger shot of getting to having submarines in the end. What do you think, Lonnie?
Yeah, I mean, I think that if they are really, really interested in building nuclear power submarines, and then they're building them in the United States, is, you know, condition, and I think that they will probably do it. And then it may cost
despite
more.
Despite the cost?
I think so. And Hanwha Ocean recently said that they can build nuclear power submarines in Philly Shipyard. I mean, they can, you know, build a dock, and then they can do take necessary measures. They have the capability to do it. And then they have already decided to, you know, South Korea has already decided to invest like $150 billion in the American shipbuilding industry. As maybe some of the money could go into that. So that, I think that, but the way I see it, though, is like South Koreans are really, really, really eager to build them, even if it costs a lot of money. And I'm not against it. I just think that we have to do cost benefit analysis. And, you know, there are a lot of things to consider. For example, you know, I'm thinking, you know, we talk about like the world becoming more transparent with advanced sensors and stuff like that. But, like, we're talking about CJASU2 and all that. We're going to be able to see everything. And China has made like significant advancement in quantum sensing and other advanced sensing capabilities. So now some in Australia are saying that by the time that its submarines are completed, nuclear power submarines are completed, they will become like billion-dollar coffins. So what if they are not stealth anymore? You know, if it takes like 10 plus years, then, you know, that is something that we have to think about. If the sensing technology will, you know, be more advanced more quickly than submarines. Another thing is, you know, will South Korea be able to find people who will be on submarines for months? Even today, Iraq Navy has a hard time finding people, you know, that are willing to go to these diesel electric submarines for weeks. And we're talking about months without smartphones. And so I'm not saying this, therefore they shouldn't build it. I'm thinking like, you know, they may think about, you know, they may have to think about, you know, unmanned, I mean, like putting robots in the submarines, then, you know, they can actually cut costs because they don't have to, you know, have like safety, you know, mechanisms, like all those nuclear, you know, safety, you know, measures. And so it was just something to think about.
I don't have a lot of experience of being on submarines. I have been in, but not a lot of experience, but I did. Long time ago, in the early 80s, I was at fire bases underground, working and sleeping underground, and did it twice, like 45 days. And so that's a long time. And that's not 6 months underground, that's 45 days. And so I think your point about people could be like, maybe I'll take something else. And there are real Manning issues that Korea is going through for a number of reasons. Birth decline coming down significantly. It's still a conscription force that's only in there for some of the services less than 2 years, others about 2 years. High-tech equipment, it's very difficult to get trained up only to leave service. These are real manning issues that have to be worked. And we've said, and in that, there's nothing about the issues of creating more crews, because you've got more, unless you retire, maybe they retire some other ones, but they serve different missions and different roles. Mm-hmm. I think the larger point, and because we can pull on this over and over on so many things, is that there are a lot of uncertainties, and Moore was trying to pull on this, that past the, man, we need to have it because we're keeping up with our neighbors, or we need to have it because that's what the big boy club does, or we need to have it because who knows of the future. Mm-hmm. A lot of those, you know, prestige needs or things like that, which is not saying South Korea is not thinking about this. I mean, they have been thinking about since the 90s, they've been thinking and moving in this direction. Slower at times, but there are a lot of unanswered questions still.
So I'm just thinking here. I mean, India builds submarines to make sure its nuclear deterrent survives. So do you think there's a case to be made for South Korea to build the submarines because it can shape regional balance without going nuclear?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think in order to, I mean, shift the military balance. I mean, I think that the way that South Koreans are thinking is that North Korea's building is that just South Korea's balancing against North Korea's. But also, it can also contribute to regional security.
Yes, yeah, so that's one. So I was talking about, there are two options, if you want, building these submarines. Mm-hmm. The other is South Korea itself going to become a nuclear.
Oh, nuclear.
So I, in that sense, isn't there a case to be made that which would probably make the case for submarines stronger?
I think some.
I just wonder.
Let me go on this further, but maybe make it easier, and I'll say something about it to release some of the pressure. But there are those who argue that South Korea is creating delivery capabilities. The Hunmu missile, which you just spoke about, has a very large conventional warhead. Take that out, put in a nuclear warhead. Submarines that can launch conventional munitions, SSNs could become, you know, SSBNs, and they could launch nuclear missiles. And so there are those who argue that that is, in fact, a path, which is why many, whether it's justifiable argument or not, people make those and concerns, which leads to, you know, the arms race and all these other things. If you're collecting capabilities, then you're getting a head start, as it were.
Yeah, so that's what my book is about.
Say more.
Yeah, so South Korean nuclear hedging strategy. So the reason why my book is titled Everything But the Bomb, South Korean nuclear hedging strategy.
Well, that's why I asked you the question, because that's the title of your book.
Right, because South Korea, you know, like part of the, some argue that part of the reasons why South Koreans are pursuing nuclear power submarines is because, although at this point they are asking the United States to provide fuel, but if South Korea can produce its own fuel, then even if it is lowly, the low in enriched uranium, 3 to 5%, it is, you know, once you have the capability, you have it. You can, you know, enrich it up to weapon grade, like 90% pretty easily. And along with advanced missiles. So a chapter of my book is entitled The Nuclear Triad Without Nukes. Basically, South Korea has very advanced delivery capabilities to launch warheads from the air, the ground, under the sea. It has recently established the Strategic Command, which is not about nuclear weapons now, but later, if South Korea acquires nuclear weapons, it may, you know, assume the role of nuclear command and control. And so, therefore, South Korea has everything but the bomb now.
That's fascinating. And you said your book's coming out next year?
This year.
Yeah, because we're already in next year.
Yeah.
It was last episode you said it was coming out next year, and so we're here now. This has been a fascinating topic. I'm so glad you brought it to us to talk about. It's extremely timely. And so there's more to be said on this, and it doesn't matter what topic we talk about, we're never going to be exhausted. I think if you're okay, I think I want to switch over to wins and woes. Did you have any?
Can I just make a last point on this? And I made a note here. What my takeaway is, the combined lessons of India, AUKUS, and South Korea is that nuclear submarines only reinforce deterrence when they are tightly bound by alliance discipline and non-proliferation constraints. Without those limits, they risk undermining the very stability that they're meant to protect. Mm. If you have a last, any comment you want to make?
Yeah.
Okay. That's it.
No, that's words to think about there. So wins and woes. Tell us.
Win first. So I almost want to say the jam session between President Lee and Japanese Prime Minister Takaichi, where they played the drum together to a BTS song. But actually my real win is Honolulu Defense Forum that occurred this week, earlier this week, hosted by Pacific Forum. I had a privilege to attend the forum where we discussed, you know, operationalizing and enhancing American readiness and deterrence. We had a lot of people from the government and the private sector, and then, you know, countries, allies and partner countries, to discuss how all of them can work together to enhance readiness and then deliver and expedite defense delivery and defense innovation. And that was really a good conference. And it was good for me to see that this, you know, this public-private, you know, cooperation is happening, and then cooperation with allies and partners is happening. So, yeah.
That was a fantastic week. And we had, as it were, an offsite here. We had the chief staff of the Armed Forces of the Philippines, General Bronner. He came here. I sat down with him for a half hour. We did an interview. And then we went into the auditorium, and it was full. We brought Indo-Pacific commander was here, and the component commanders were here, and just we filled the room, and he spoke about the armed forces of the Philippines and being a reliable partner in the region. And it was moderated that the session was really good, and then they went back off to the Honolulu Defense Forum and did those things. That was a It has been a real good week. Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Sean.
Can I start with a woe? Because it's weighing very heavily on me. Well, Lamy is leaving us.
No. You can't go there yet. You're on the win.
Okay, the win. The win, I think, I think we at the APCSS have launched a program bringing in adjunct professors. Yeah. The program was for a long time in gestation. It took a long time.
This is true.
But now it's rolling, and I think we have a first batch, and I think that's great for us because we have more expertise to beef up, to support that what we already have. And I think that's a great one because I've seen it gestate for a long time, and now to see it happen was a great feeling.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And so we got a lot of talent coming in through the doors, and we'll be able to expand them. To be honest, I plan to have a whole bunch of them sit down with me and dialogue, and we'll interview them and do those things. And so we have plans for that as well. I love your win, and I'm going to just pull on that a minute, Lamy. And of course, Tuesday earlier this week, President Lee and Prime Minister Takaichi, they sat down. You're right. She's a former Hard Rock. She played the drums, right?
Yeah, she was really good.
And so, that just wasn't something she thought for the thing. This is part of who she is. And anyhow, so they met. This was the third meeting in as many months. I mean, they met on the sides of APEC, and also then in October, and then G20 in November. And so here they are now coming together. You talked about this bonding that they had. South Korea is also looking, I guess they've expressed interest in joining the CPTPP, the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement on Trans-Pacific Partnership. Japan's reiterated that progress needs to hinge on their resolving the post-Fukushima seafood ban that they've got, and so there's some things there. But you know, normalization of the strategic coordination between these states is important, and it's good to see them in that direction.
Definitely.
Woes, Lamy.
A fascinating but a concerning article in the New York Times about this Chinese scientist who went to jail several years ago after genetically editing embryos that resulted in three births. He's not being shunned by the Chinese society. Actually, he has resumed his work in genetic, editing, gene editing. Which means that the Chinese government is not really actually trying to stop it and actually encouraging the advancement of biotechnology. And this scientist himself, who's now called Dr. Frankenstein, and other people argue that actually because of this all ethical regulations that the United States has, China will be, you know, far more advanced than the United States in biotechnology. So
if
that,
they aren't already.
Yeah,
they are. You're absolutely right. Mm-hmm. This is a concerning where this is going, because they're clearly probably in the lead, but say more.
Right. I mean, so it is really concerning because, I mean, it could be now his research was about preventing HIV and other diseases, but it could be used to, you know, sort of produce, you know, like more cognitively, physically stronger people, and then maybe more, you know, submissive to the authoritarian regimes. And also, you know, this could give China with military advantage as well. And so that creates a dilemma for the United States, along with other emerging technologies that we're talking about, like lethal autonomous weapons and others. You know, we have a dilemma of whether to advance these technologies because our adversaries are doing it, or we have to put sort of ethical standards and, you know, meet ethical standards and have to put more regulations. And so that's a tough question.
Yeah, I had asked Elsa Kania to write a piece on this, on the biotech, and for the book. And so it's this is a an issue of great concern that many people aren't tracking.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Well, I think not in order of priority. I'm looking at the unrest in Iran.
Yeah.
And some people want to call it unraveling. I'm not sure I want to go there yet. But the potential fallout in India and South Asia, what it could be. So I'm working on that issue. So that's quite woeful.
Yep.
But my larger woe is Lami's leaving us.
Well, so now that you've said that, say more, Salami.
Yeah, I mean, I've been really enjoying working with you and at the center of the past 3 years at the center, and for the past about 6 years at the U.S. Department of Defense. But I'm leaving to join the International Institute for Strategic Studies based in London as Korea chair. It's bittersweet. I'm sad to leave Hawaii and the center, but I'm also excited to continue my work there on military and defense issues in the Korean Peninsula and in the Indo-Pacific.
We are definitely going to miss you. You have been a joy to work with.
I smell a win here, James.
Hmm.
I can see us doing this podcast in London at
So we just need allow me to send a paid invite. That would be wonderful. I want to pull a little bit on. So my woe is actually a little bit tied to the region we were just talking about. And so earlier this month, last week, China imposed sweeping export controls on Japan because of comments that Prime Minister Takeuchi had made during the Diet during Parliament, where she had talked about if in a contingency situation in Taiwan, that this could constitute a threat to Japan and national security and may necessitate a military response. And so as a result, China then levied dual-use goods export controls, quite onerous. We'll see how they are in implementation, but there's 800. And so this could affect is intended to definitely affect the military, and it can greatly affect the civilians as well, and it could be extremely administratively burdensome. Maybe more so than the rare earths, which are also tied in this. And so so this escalation between the two, I mean, it was more than 2 months. This was back in November when Takeuchi made that comment, and it still is moving forward. And so I don't think we've seen the last of it.
No.
Though it caused her popularity to go up,
of course,
because of this going on. But I think there could be some real concerns to be.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, now we are sort of seeing a rallying around the flag effect. Indeed. However, if the sanctions continue and then if Japanese people really start to, you know.
Yeah, once it hits your stomach, then your sense of nationalism gets diluted.
Yeah, yeah. So we'll see where that goes. Well, so as we look to the future, What do you got coming in a little bit? Now, we already know that you're leaving us soon and going to London, but what else you've got?
So the my priority now is to find a dog-friendly apartment in London.
It must be difficult.
I'm not really sure, but my dog will be already like very unhappy that I took her to London from Hawaii. And so, yeah, I'm a little bit nervous about this. Yeah.
Well, I hope you get that resolved. My son and his family, actually pre-COVID, were there in London and then came back during COVID as things were complicated as they were. They were in between dogs as theirs had passed, and then they got another one on the way back. But yeah, this could be a real issue anywhere, but internationally it could be tough.
Yeah, tough.
Sham, how about you? What's coming up for you?
Well, I've got, I'm prepping for the workshop, the India-US Defense Industrial Base workshop. That's slated for September, or tentatively. And then I've got a course to lead, the senior level course, Transnational Security Cooperation. That's sometime in July. And in between all that, I want to make sure that I don't take my eye off my writing.
Yeah,
I need to do that at a steady pace.
Appreciate
even it. I have a deadline to submit my draft.
Yeah, we know your book's got to go in.
So. Yeah, so I've got to make sure I do some good time management here.
Busy.
I'm going to get on a plane tomorrow morning, and I'm going to fly to Brunei. I'll be there for a week. I'm going to do a site visit in preparation for the Indo-Pacific Senior Enlisted Leaders Subject Matter Expert Exchange. We call that IPSL-SME. Back in 2024, instituted this with Indo-PACOM. In fact, at the time, now SEAC, Dave Isom, who was the command senior enlisted leader then. We worked together over a period of time on this. We did the first two iterations here in Hawaii. Now Brunei, they're going to celebrate their 65th Armed Forces Day celebration in May. June, we're going to conduct it. We'll send out invitations to 30 countries for three students per, as it were, to come in, and we will spend a week there.
So looking at 90.
And so
90. Participants.
Yeah, so around about 90, and so we'll do that there. So we're going to go out there and do a site survey and get ready for that. Meet with people from the military and even the U.S. Embassy and stuff out there. So really looking forward to moving this along, and so that's what I've got coming up. There is no chance of anyone getting bored in the work we do here. There
of
is
course.
Always
no chance of getting bored.
Thank you for joining us again for this one right here, and we'll do it again.
Without you.
Well, Nami, bestest wishes. Good luck.
Thank you.
And we'll see you in London.
Yeah, I'm sure.
At some point. And James, thanks very much for this.
Thank you.
This is a great effort. And I think that's the other win for me. I was going to suggest that we are on track now.
We are.
After some hiccups in the beginning, the first one, I think we're rolling, unfortunately. we'll have to do one session in London, but I keep hoping.
Well, let me close this out. From all of us at the Daniel K. Inouye Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies, thank you for joining Strategic Voices. Be sure to join us again next month for our next live show. For Professor Sham Tukwani and Lami Kim, I'm James Minnick, and until we meet again, aloha. As always, the opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI, APCSS, the U.S. Department of Defense, or the U.S. government.